Today, I want you to meet a most fascinating woman. She spent more than 30 years in Ungarda Síochána. She worked at Interpol and FIFA, a behavioural psychologist. She has literally written the book on how to conduct interviews with criminal suspects. Geraldine Noon played a critical role in the investigation of the brutal murder of Eoláin O'Hara and the subsequent conviction, 10 years ago now, of Graeme Dwyer, surely one of Ireland's most notorious killers. She's just contributed to a major new documentary on that case, which is currently streaming on Prime Video.
It was very clear from the communication between himself and Eoláin, we're dealing with somebody who is very callous, very indifferent to anybody else, feels completely lacking in empathy, completely focused on his own desires, his own behaviours, very dismissive of Eoláin and any of her feelings. Very poor impulse control, very high on goal-focused, callous behaviour. All high psychopathic traits.
It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty, and today we're talking about forensic psychology, the art of the police interview, and how Graeme Dwyer was finally made to answer for his crimes. Geraldine Noon, thanks so much for joining us on News Talk Daily.
Hello, Ciara. Thank you so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Why did you join Ungarda Síochána? What attracted you to the force?
Oh, I was very young. I was just out of school. I was already kind of a feminist. A woman can do anything a man can. Actually, there was a TV program on then called Police Woman from America, and I was fascinated with her and I loved her. And of course, I thought that could be me. But anyway, I applied and got them and I was so happy and I loved my career from the moment I entered until the moment I left. Ups and downs, but it really did deliver everything I had hoped it would.
And what was that, Geraldine?
Excitement, variety, involvement with people. I don't want to sound like Rose of Tralee-ish, but the ability to help or to do things, practical things for people.
And at what stage in your career did you sort of pivot and think, you know, I'm going to get into more of the behavioural side of the work of the Gardaí? When did you decide to study forensic psychology?
Well, I started to study psychology first. I didn't know what forensic psychology was then. Very early on, because as a young woman and a young guard, and there was very few women in my back then, we were always segued and siloed into investigating crimes against women and children, you know, the sexual crimes and all of those things. And so the only thing that qualified you for that was your gender. And of course, we were completely underqualified and did an absolutely abysmal job. It frightens me to think how badly we conducted ourselves back then through the lack of guidance and training and knowledge, you know. So very early on, I knew I needed to do better and I could do better. So I started to study psychology to see if that would help along the way, and it did. And then of course that grew and developed until we came to developing the national interviewing protocol back in 2012 to ensure that all Gardaí had at least a basic level of training at interviewing, and then that developed into the competency framework where Gardaí are trained at various levels to interview various levels of complexity and to ensure that their interviews with victims, witnesses and suspects are done at the appropriate level with the appropriate skill.
So as a young Gardaí, you really felt there was an opportunity to be more strategic in interviews?
Not even strategic. At that stage, it was just, how can I do this better? How can I get an information from a person that will be admissible in court without causing them more trauma? Because we were interviewing and over-interviewing and re-interviewing, doing all those things that we now know is completely anathema to people's well-being and health, you know, people who've already suffered trauma, and we're re-traumatizing them to get the information from them. And then often, even when we did that, it wasn't good enough to pass the standards of the DPP to get to court. So, I mean, that's at the extremes. Of course, there was often times when it was fine, but I was very aware that we just weren't doing it well enough.
So what did psychology and then forensic psychology teach you, Geraldine?
It gave me a real awareness of how trauma and various things that impact on people, how it impacts on their memory, on their ability to tell their story, on their ability to recreate what happened to them. It also gave me an insight into how better questioning techniques, better ability to engage and to listen to people, and then to document their narrative, their story in the way they told it. That's probably the key thing. Allow people to tell their story, listen to them and hear them, and don't be so focused on the facts and on what we, the investigators, want to know. Let them tell their story, and that information will come out of their story if we have the patience and the skill to draw it out.
Let's look at the murder of Elaine O'Hara and the investigation by the Gardaí into her death. At what point were you brought in?
So as soon as the body was identified, I was asked to become involved, really, as the interview advisor. I was the national interview advisor at the time. So it was about developing interview strategies for both witnesses and ultimately for a suspect if one did arise. There wasn't one at that point, but we're always looking down the road to the point when a suspect will be arrested. It's too late then to think about the strategy, really. You have to be thinking about it in advance and ensuring that all the groundwork is laying so that we have a good foundation when the suspect is eventually brought in.
So what are you looking at this point, Geraldine?
So I suppose essentially you're looking at the what happened, in order to see why it happened, and then ultimately who might have done this or what type of person might have done this. But you're also looking at what evidence we have so far, who might be a witness. I mean, clearly the family are witnesses, their close friends are witnesses, people who've seen her last. All of those witnesses need to be spoken to very early, and or there's, if they were spoken to earlier in the missing persons investigation, then you need to review all of those statements, all of that information, to see if there's anything missing, anything that can be developed upon. I mean, new lines of inquiry that can now be more relevant, considering now we know we're talking about homicide or murder.
So when you looked at the investigation and the material that had been gathered by the team, whether that was the BDSM paraphernalia or the mobile phones, what kind of personality did it suggest?
You're looking at traits, you're looking at behaviours, you're looking at the type of behavior. And then, of course, what was the phones were really important to us, because then you're looking at conversations and interactions that the suspect actually had with the victim and vice versa. Those are crucial. Those are vital. Those are just golden to have in this kind of a case, and they're not often available. So it was very early on, you thinking about narcissistic, maybe antisocial personality types because of the behavior he was engaging in, because of the kind of manipulation and controlling behaviours, but also coupled with kind of charming, charismatic behaviour, which is kind of typical of a narcissistic going towards the antisocial personality type. Also lots of compulsive behaviour and risk-taking, which again would go towards that personality type. It's not about diagnosing him, it's just about seeing the patterns of behaviour that are there that may give us clues into his type and ultimately then his interactions and his behaviours and how he will engage with the investigation team ultimately. So there was a good few clues and signals there that we were probably dealing with as somebody who had a high traits in narcissistic personality disorder or even antisocial personality disorder.
And what were those behaviours?
Those were a grandiose sense of self. He was quite boastful and talked himself up and talked up his hobbies and his lifestyle. There was his ability to manipulate and his very controlling behaviour of Elaine. It was a complete lack of empathy and his disregard, his kind of lack of self-awareness in terms of how his pressure and his behaviour was impacting on Elaine, but also might impact on other people in his life. His complete lack of any ability to take responsibility for anything that did happen to him. Things that might have gone wrong in work, things that might have gone wrong in terms of financial problems. And all of those traits actually played out in the interview room again, and we kind of anticipated that they would. He was constantly seeking to blame other people for the position he found himself, you know, the press, the media, the guard, the interviewers themselves.
And you were also quite taken, you speak about in the documentary, with the fact that he was quite happy or seemed to be oblivious or unconcerned about the fact that he was on CCTV quite regularly going in and out of Elaine O'Hara's apartment.
Yeah, well, we see him early on, the first few visits. He looked at the camera, tried to direct his face away from it, but I mean, no real attempt to disguise himself. He could have disguised himself a lot better. He could have found another way of avoiding cameras, but he didn't. And that would tend to go towards the compulsive behavior, the sense of grandiosity, his own belief in his ability to get away with these crimes. So we were always believed or had the instinct that he would deny. And if he absolutely had to accept some contact with Elaine, then it would always be that it was a legitimate consensual relationship, but never led to murder. Somebody else was involved in the murder, you know. So he sort of had that plan worked out in his head very early on. From the moment he knew there was CCTV cameras potentially in her apartment, he knew that he wanted to go and have these interactions with her. He wasn't going to stymie his impulse to that to the extent of not going there at all, but he would have some rationalization, some story for it if he ever was challenged about it by anybody else in the future. That goes towards that personality type, taking risks, a sense of bravado, a kind of sense that he would be able to get away with it in the end somehow. And he did play it out right through to the end, of course.
And on the basis of this personality type that you'd suggested, you reckoned, for example, that Graham Dwyer would not be violent or would not be aggressive when Gardaí went to his house to arrest him that morning, which was something that they actually were concerned about. Why was that?
First of all, these personality types are highly associated with violent aggression behaviour, but only in the specific context in which they want to achieve their goals. So this type of personality is very goal-orientated. And of course, we know what Graham Dwyer's goal was. It would never be to take on the Gardaí. Of course, in investigating Gardaí, are always conscious and they have to have a risk assessment before they go to any arrest situation to determine if it's going to be a risk to the members themselves, to the public in general, or to the people within the house or the person they're arresting. So these are always things they have to take into account. But judging from his personality type and the way he could compartmentalize and the mask that was implied in the title of that documentary, the psychological mask he wore when he was with Elaine would never be the same one he'd wear with arresting Gardaí. He wouldn't. It was my contention that he would submit calmly to the arrest, come to the interviews and do exactly what he did, which was play it out and ultimately give a rationalisation that wasn't accepted by a judge and jury, but which he felt was rational from his perspective.
When it comes to the psychological assessment that you did, Geraldine, how instrumental do you think it was in guiding the direction and the tone of the Garda interview? And in what way did it, I suppose, influence how questions perhaps were framed or prioritised?
It was instrumental, certainly. It played a huge role in the interview strategy. All interviews need to be considered in an interviewee-specific context. Who are we interviewing? What are they going to bring to the dynamic? How will that affect our interview strategy? How will that affect the ultimate outcome? So a skilled interviewer will always look to trying to identify what this particular person is going to bring to the party, and then how am I going to manage that within the interviewing context? For example, a less skilled interviewer, somebody who hadn't engaged in a strategy, hadn't sit down and spoken about it, could have fallen into the trap that somebody of this personality type can set for them, which is either to create a situation where there's conflict in the interview room, or they might close down altogether and not give any information at all, which won't add any value to the investigation. So it's really important. It was very important, but it was only important in the context of how the interviews with used it. And of course, the interviewer in this case, Peter Woods, was very skilled enough to seek the advice, skilled enough to take the advice, and then to go with the dynamic of the interview and make it his own.
And I suppose in this case, because there was no cause of death, because there was no murder weapon, the evidence was all circumstantial, the interview of Graham Dwyer was going to potentially provide really crucial evidence, wasn't it?
The interviews were absolutely central. They're central to all investigations, but they were critical in this context. Evidence is circumstantial, and of course, many a person has been convicted on circumstantial evidence. It's the coming together of all the circumstantial evidence. But that all comes together in the interview room before it ever comes together in a trial, you know? It has to be built upon and managed, and the narrative has to be drawn, first of all, from the witnesses, and then brought together in the interview with the suspect and draw a narrative from him or her to make that circumstances alive, to give it meaning, to give it context. So it was crucial that he spoke to us. It was crucial that he engaged a narrative around the specific pieces of evidence before he knew what those pieces of evidence were. So it's about strategically using the evidence, not just presenting it.
Yeah, and that comes across really clearly, actually, if you watch the documentary, is that Peter Woods, the investigating Gardaí there, sort of engaged in what sounded like quite casual conversation with Graham Dwyer about his life, his hobbies, his work. And yet what he was really doing was getting Graham Dwyer to speak and confirm details that he had texted Elaine O'Hara that would link him back to the mobile phone. And it was clear that Dwyer did all of this without being aware of what it was the Gardaí were doing. And it was only later in the interview that he said to the Gardaí, "Oh, now I see why you were asking me that." But it was too late at that stage. He had confirmed details which linked him to these really important phones.
Totally, yeah. Peter gave us a masterclass in how to conduct an interview in this context. And Graham Dwyer, this narcissistic personality type, if he has one, playing into that as well, because he couldn't help himself. When he was given the floor to speak, he wanted to speak. And it also gave him a false sense of security because he was talking about stuff he felt comfortable with. And he thought that's buying him time where he didn't have to talk about the stuff he wasn't so comfortable with. But of course, it came to that as well. And he did have to talk about the stuff that he wasn't that comfortable with because he had been speaking in such free dialogue. It would have seemed incongruent not then to answer the more difficult questions when they came.
I think what's fascinated and disturbed so many people who read and followed what happened to Elaine O'Hara and the subsequent investigation and trial into Graham Dwyer was his ability to maintain this normal, functional public life, being a family man, having children, keeping down a job, while living and harbouring these really violent fantasies. How do you explain that?
I think human nature is very complex. I mean, that's what psychology tells us, isn't it? People are very complex. We all have our own secret lives and thoughts, and we're different people in different contexts. The idea that when people's personality is slightly disordered, that becomes more exaggerated. And of course, they engage in behaviors, they move from the fantasy or from the secret life in their heads to bringing it into the world, to bringing it into reality. But it's the circumstance and the context, certainly in Graham Dwyer's case, that helped him to bring his fantasy to reality and to play it out. It's the interaction with the context and the situation he creates, obviously, and develops, but then manages to, obviously, in this case, manipulate and control somebody who was vulnerable, and he identified that vulnerability. And that's also a skill of these people with this particular personality disorder, persuasive personality traits, is to identify people who they can manipulate and control.
Are they born that way? Was Graham Dwyer born evil, do you think, Geraldine?
I wouldn't go with the term evil in the first place, but are they born with personality disorders? It's not very clear yet, but there seems to be neuroscience is telling us a lot about that now. There certainly seems to be a difference in their makeup, a difference in their neurological makeup than there is from people who don't have this personality type. And it's the area of the brain that controls impulse control, that controls our ability to have empathy. All of that kind of thing is structured slightly different in this personality type. Whether they're born that way or whether it's developed through nurture still isn't that clear, but certainly nurture does play a role. Not necessarily the lack of nurture, but something in developmental stages that might have a role in it.
So do you believe somebody like Graham Dwyer can be rehabilitated?
At this point in his life and at this point in the development of neuroscience, I would say not. I'd say certainly they can be managed if they wished to be managed, but probably not treated. It's not something that can be reversed.
Geraldine, I know you got into this business in part because you were concerned about the treatment of victims in the investigating process. You mentioned that at the beginning. Do you worry that the victims of crime, that somebody like Elaine O'Hara, you know, that they get overlooked in how crime, especially violent crime, is discussed and reported upon in this country?
I'm very concerned about that. Not just in how it's looked and reported, but how it's treated in the trial.
as well. I mean, you'll often see in interpersonal crime like rape and murder of women, in particular domestic violence, there's a lot of victim blaming going on. There's a lot of the victim is on trial. There's a lot of reporting about their own personal style or their own personal behaviour that's absolutely nothing to do with the crime. They have to justify themselves so much. It's frightening. The defence strategy seems to be to attack the witness in a lot of cases. And it's really horrifying. And I think it has a huge impact on the attrition rate in terms of interpersonal violence. People refuse to report it, or they do report it, but they don't go through to the trial stage because it just becomes too much for them. That's really so unfair. There has to be a better way of doing that as well.
And I did feel that. I followed this trial really, really closely, and it was so difficult at times to see so many elements of Elaine O'Hara's personality and her private life just being exposed and ripped apart in a courtroom.
Totally. And you have to do it all through the investigation, because if the investigators don't do it, the defence team will do it anyway, and then the investigation is left with a big gap in it, you know. So it has to be done in anticipation of the defence. But it's so unfair. I mean, her personal diaries, her conversations with her therapist and her counsellor, it's so invasive. It's so invasive for a victim. And because the victim is dead, doesn't make it any less invasive.
Final question, Geraldine. In your opinion, can forensic psychology be better integrated into criminal investigations in Ireland going forward?
I think it can be better integrated by being more integrated, I think, is a big role for it. And I think it would be useful if psychologists were consulted at an earlier point, not just forensic psychology. Sometimes it might be a cognitive psychologist or a psychiatric expert or something. There's a lot of more vulnerable people being interviewed now, a lot more issues that needs to be considered. But I think we've come a long way. I think the Gardaí have very skilled interviewers now. They're doing a lot in terms of their training for Gardaí, and it really is showing. It really is making a huge impact in the outcomes in trials in the recent past. And I think that's great to see. And I think that's only going to improve with time. And the more you have senior investigating officers appreciating that role, the more that will change. And trials and reporting and exposure like journalists are giving it will also help that a lot.
Geraldine, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us on News Talk Daily. Well, Murderer Behind the Mask, that documentary series that I mentioned, featuring Geraldine's memories of the investigation and the prosecution of Graeme Dwyer, it's now streaming on Prime Video. That's it from News Talk Daily. We'll be back again tomorrow. You'll find us on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. But between now and then, be sure to like or follow the podcast to make sure you never miss out on an episode. But until then, bye-bye.